This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss the midlife metabolism reset with naturopath Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We'll learn about the importance of communication with author Molly Chang. We'll find out how to be a continuous vegetable gardener with gardener and author Charlie Nardozzi. And lastly, we'll discover how and why you should demolish your comfort zones with author Art Turek. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. A new study from Northwestern University shows that the gut microbiome can directly affect how the brain works, revealing a strong link between microbes and brain activity. Humans have very large brains compared to body size, but scientists still don't fully understand how brains evolve to meet their high energy needs. This research offers new clues by showing that gut microbes play an important role in brain function and development. The research team, led by biological anthropologist Katie Amato, studied gut microbes from primates from different brain sizes. They transferred microbes from humans and squirrel monkeys, who are large brain primates, and macaques, a smaller brain primate, into mice that had no microbes of their own. After 8 weeks, the mice showed clear difference in brain activity. Mice given microbes from large brain primates had higher activity in genes linked to energy production and learning. In contrast, mice that received microbes from smaller brain primates shown gene patterns linked to conditions such as ADHD, autism, and schizophrenia. These findings suggest that gut microbes may help shape brain development and could influence mental health. Scientists believe this research may lead to new ways of understanding brain disorders and human evolution. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: The Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Colleen Hartwick in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal. Organic or wild-crafted, these oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. Dr. Colleen Hartwick is a licensed naturopathic physician who's been in private practice since 2012 in Campbell River, BC. Dr. Hartwick has a special interest in trauma as it pertains to physical illness, and as such, her practice focuses on mental health. In addition, Dr. Hartwick is passionate about sharing her knowledge and has been a part-time instructor at the Canadian School for Nutrition since 2015, and she publishes educational articles with Naturopathic Currents. Welcome back to the show and Happy New Year, Colleen. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. So glad to be back here and kicking off the new year with a great topic for today's conversation.
Right. So I have like throughout my life, I've had a brutal metabolism. I'm a slow burner, let's call it. But yeah. I've noticed as I get older, it's gotten even worse. And I think I'm not alone. I think people who are even younger than me in their 40s, you know, they feel like their body just isn't responding the way it used to. Is that real or is that perception? What's going on?
Yeah, as a person who recently turned 40, I can also personally attest to the fact that the things I used to do in my 20s aren't working quite the same. So it's not just you and me. This is a common trend that around the age of 40, you know, plus or minus a couple of years, our metabolism starts to change. For women, we're entering that perimenopausal time of life where estrogen, progesterone, and even testosterone levels tend to drop. And for men, you get to go through what's known as andropause, where your testosterone levels around the age of 40 start to drop. And those hormones have huge implications in terms of our muscle mass, our insulin sensitivity, so our ability to use carbs as an energy source, and overall metabolic rate.
So what are the biggest changes you tend to see in your patients once they hit 40?
So it's usually like, late 30s, early 40s is, and I see mostly women, although more and more men are coming into the office, which I'm really happy about, that they're being more proactive with their health. So big things I see is complaints about gaining weight, 10, 15 pounds, feeling a little bit more tired, not tolerating carbohydrates quite as well. But I'd say probably the biggest one I see is everything I've been doing before, my diet, my exercise doesn't seem to be working anymore. I'm putting on weight. What's going on?
So why is it that eating less and exercising more stops working?
So there's a couple of factors at play. So the first one being the changes in sex hormones. So for women, what seems to be the biggest factor that impacts our metabolism is drops in both estrogen and, to a lesser degree, testosterone. Both of those hormones, but estrogen a little bit more in us women, really helps with insulin sensitivity. So our ability to uptake carbohydrates in the cells and use those as fuel. So as estrogen levels start to drop in our 40s, even late 30s, we don't use carbs as well as fuel, we can develop what's called insulin resistance. And with that, there's more of a tendency for, instead of carbs to be used as fuel for our activity, for our work, it starts to get stored as fat. Testosterone, and to a degree, estrogen, also regulates our ability to produce muscle. So it becomes more difficult to put on that really important, lean, metabolically active tissue known as muscle. For men, the story is a little bit more different because you have less estrogen and progesterone than women do. So as men come into their 40s, testosterone levels, it really starts to dip off after about 25, if I'm being honest. But it becomes more obvious the change in testosterone around the age of 40. So again, we'll tend to experience more difficulty putting on muscle, maybe some muscle loss, especially if you're not particularly physically active, not doing a lot of strength or resistance training. And with that, some insulin resistance as well, and putting on fat as well as, again, the losing of the muscle mass.
So if we're conceptualizing a midlife metabolism reset, which is the kind of theme of what we're talking about today, what does that mean from a naturopathic perspective?
Yeah, so I think a big part of it is, again, I see people come into the office and they're super frustrated, and rightfully so, that like, I'm doing all the right things. Why isn't it working? And what they're doing was right for them maybe in their 20s and 30s. But now that they're at a different stage in their life, it's time to shift gears and understand that the body that you're in is working differently than it did 10, 15, 20 years ago. And so we've got to work with it as opposed to against it. So that for me is a big part of the reset, is in part a mindset reset, thinking differently about our body, that our body needs different things at different points in our life.
So is this where people need to shift their focus away from weight loss towards metabolic health? In other words, the goal becomes different?
Absolutely. And if I'm being honest, when I work with patients at any age, I find they get more success if the primary motivation isn't weight loss, because weight can be so variable, especially for us women. We can put on 5 pounds before a period. You're like, oh my gosh, I'm gaining weight. And you're like, no, you're just retaining water. But it can be really frustrating. People can lose their motivation and their consistency if the primary end goal is weight loss. So again, at any age, try to see if patients can look at different outcomes, getting stronger, having better energy, having better endurance, and looking for those metrics. We tend to get more consistency and fewer instances of feeling like what I'm doing is not working.
So does nutrition need to change after 40?
Yes, it does. So as I mentioned, for both men and women, there's more of a tendency towards insulin resistance. So not using carbs as well as an energy source. And it's not to say you have to go totally carb-free, but if your diet has been richer in carbohydrates, so starchy things, grains, you may want to do a little bit less of that as well in both men and women. As we get around the age of 40, our muscles become less sensitive to dietary protein. So as I mentioned, it can be harder to put on muscle mass, and it takes more dietary protein to build or maintain the muscle that you already have. So big priorities in that 40 years of age is eat more protein, especially early in the day, and maybe look at the carbohydrate content of your diet and not be too restrictive, but maybe do a little less.
So for a lot of people, intermittent fasting seems to work, but is that something that you can do in midlife, or do you have to reconsider it?
Yeah. So intermittent fasting, my favorite phrase when I'm teaching is it depends. It really does depend on the person. So I think broadly, men do tend to tolerate fasting a little bit better than your average woman. It's not to say women can't intermittent fast, but our brains, the part of the brain that really regulates things like reproduction and hormone balance, known as the hypothalamus, is a little bit more sensitive to calorie restrictions. So really important if you're considering intermittent fasting, I think, to consult with someone just to help ensure that it's going to be safe and appropriate for you. But I think for the vast majority of people, narrowing that feeding window to maybe 6 or 8 hours as a male, maybe 10 to 12 hours for a female, can be beneficial, because when we're in the fasted state, it gives us an opportunity to do tissue healing and repair, to go into stored energy, known as fat, to use that as an energy source. And we can help to regain our insulin sensitivity if insulin resistance is part of our health picture.
So in your practice, what's the nutrition mistake that you see most often in this cohort?
I see a lot of women in practice, and inevitably the conversation comes down nutritionally to, well, a couple key things: getting enough fiber, but getting enough protein. I see almost universally, with some exception, women are not eating enough protein. Men, the ones that I've worked with, tend to eat a little bit more, so it's less of a concern for them. So it's the underconsumption of protein. And what I tend to advocate for as a general rule of thumb is have a substantial source of protein, whether it's animal protein or plant protein, every meal, somewhere 25 to 30-ish grams, which would be like a heaping cup of Greek yogurt, to make sure you're hitting that nutritional milestone to, again, help build and maintain that metabolically active muscle tissue.
Let's shift gears to movement and exercise. Do changes need to be made at this stage in the way that we move?
Yes, absolutely. So again, as I mentioned, the changes in hormones, also forgot to mention that with changing sex hormones, we can also become, as both men and women, more sensitive to the stress hormone cortisol, which can accelerate muscle breakdown. And so what becomes critical in sort of midlife, it's weird to think that I'm at midlife, but here we are. Strength training, resistance training is crucial. If you're not lifting heavy things, and heavy is going to be relative to the individual, start now, right? We want to build and maintain skeletal muscle because it is a metabolic powerhouse. It acts as a storehouse for carbohydrates, for glucose, and it burns so much energy at rest that it really helps us maintain our metabolism. Plus, working muscles are protective against cognitive decline, so an added benefit of preserving memory and cognition if we're lifting heavy a couple times a week. And of course, other forms of activity are still important in our 40s, getting cardio, because it has its own set of benefits, both for the brain, for the heart, for the lungs. Mobility training, also important. But I would say if you had to pick from any mode of activity to prioritize in the midlife, it's strength training, because I see a lot of people not doing that.
Let's shift gears and talk about stress, because okay, we're all under a lot of stress. How big a role does stress play in our metabolism?
It's huge. So if you think about stress in terms of the stress response, it's really there to keep us alive, right?
Yep.
Because they're, you know, historically we would have maybe invading tribes to ward off against, or predators, right? So we've got our stress response system that's ruled by some key hormones, adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol, there to keep us alive. And what those hormones do in the short to medium term is, well, they increase your heart rate, increase your blood pressure, they increase your blood sugar or blood glucose levels, because glucose is our fast burning fuel. And if we need to fight or flee, we want a lot of glucose ready. These hormones can also, in the medium to long term, increase inflammation. And inflammation, I like to think of it as a rusting agent that could rust important receptors like the insulin receptor, so contribute to that insulin resistance. And so we see a characteristic picture when there's a lot of stress over a long period of time of a little bit of muscle wasting, which makes that insulin resistance picture worse. And the stereotypical, what many people know of, is stress belly, putting on fat around the viscera, around the organs in the midsection. So stress is a huge player in metabolism. It can also do some fun stuff to thyroid and change our thyroid hormone picture, which adds to the metabolic dysfunction that we could see, especially in midlife, because our brains, our bodies become a lot more sensitive to those stress hormones.
So part of preventative health is making small incremental changes. What's one change that people could make when it comes to stress and metabolism that perhaps is underestimated?
I think the biggest one for me, and it's because I've always prioritize it without realizing maybe why, is sleep.
Yeah,
sleep
for sure.
is such a foundation for overall health. If you're not getting enough sleep, not enough hours, not enough good quality sleep, maybe you got some apnea or something like that, that increases our production of stress hormones. It can muck up our appetite centers, and then we crave food. We're less satiated by food. Also, if you are working out, especially weight training, but even if it's not weight training, but other forms of activity, all of the gains we get from training actually happen when you're sleeping. So if you're wanting to recover and build muscle, you have to be sleeping somewhere between 7 to 9 hours a night. And with technology and screen time and doom scrolling, a lot of people are not getting as much sleep and not as much good quality sleep.
Yeah, I can tell you. And I average about 6 a night, and it drives me bananas. So I think we've covered all the lifestyle things that we can do: food, movement, sleep, stress. What about supplements? Are there supplements that you would recommend for people in their 40s that you think might help with some issues?
Yeah, I would say, again, based on what your diet is looking like, you may consider something like a protein powder just to help make sure you're getting somewhere around, doesn't have to be exactly this, but somewhere around a gram of protein per pound you weigh is kind of the aim. Oftentimes people don't quite hit that, but if you're trying to approximate that 1 gram of protein per pound you weigh, very likely you're getting plenty of protein. To help support energy systems and the systems that help us use carbohydrates as an energy source, B-complex can be a really nice foundational supplement to take. You could look at some specific versions of niacin, like NMN, that really help with mitochondrial function. Mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell, so helping to keep those mini cell organs in tip-top shape, really crucial for metabolic health. If there is a lot of stress in your life, as can be the case in our 40s, oftentimes people are working, may have kids, it's a lot to balance. So maybe looking at some adaptogens to help buffer the impact of stress, maybe some ashwagandha, maybe some rhodiola, some holy basil, and give consideration to those. I really love magnesium. It's become sort of tried and true in practice. People who are magnesium deficient tend to have more exaggerated stress responses, so they produce more cortisol. Plus, we know magnesium is really helpful for sleep because it helps us make serotonin and melatonin, and most people aren't getting enough magnesium in their diet, so I'd absolutely consider extra magnesium to, again, help with stress tolerance and improve sleep quality.
Time for one last question, and that is, if listeners take one mindset shift away from our discussion, what would you want it to be?
I guess it would be, and this might apply at any point in your life, is work with the body that you have instead of resisting what is. I think it spares you some suffering and some frustration and some added stress if we learn to work with our body instead of against it.
Yeah, and it makes it easier to actually do what you need to do if you're not, you know, breaking down a lot, you know? I think that's what you're getting at. Thanks so much for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. I love these conversations.
That was Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the importance of communication on The Tonic. This just in. Time thieves have been spotted across Canada. We've received reports of influencers and content creators stealing countless precious hours from hardworking citizens everywhere. Reports indicate thousands of hours worth of pickleball games, Pilates classes, and shooting hoops have been stolen thus far. Authorities are urging Canadians to stay alert and protect their physical activity time. Let's make room to move. Brought to you by Participaction.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Molly Chang, founder of Abella Consulting and Say It Skillfully, Inc., empowers senior management teams to win as one. With expertise in over 80 mergers and acquisitions, she has guided executives through the intricate human dynamics of transformational change and growth. Molly helps leaders cultivate mutual commitment, enabling them to excel in complex, high-stakes environments. Through Say It Skillfully, she equips individuals at all levels with the skills to communicate effectively and authentically. Her mission is to empower everyone to be seen, heard, and understood, especially when tackling their most critical challenges. Welcome to the show, Molly. How are you?
Jamie, it is a pleasure to be here, and I am doing wonderfully. How about you?
I'm doing really well. So you're new to the show, but regular listeners know that before I had this gig, I was a commercial litigator, which is all about communication. And I'm a big proponent of communication as it pertains to overall health and wellness. So you're also about communication. What is skillful communication and why is it such a vital topic? How does it fit in?
Well, I appreciate that you get that this is the most empowering and freeing skill for any of us at work and really in our lives. And I think in short, when I think of skillful communication, which I have synonymous as effective communication, mm-hmm. is when all the relevant voices are heard and we have mutual understanding. That's it. In a little pithy marketing saying, it's about being who you are and saying what needs to be said.
What do you think makes a good communicator then?
For sure, it's being grounded in our own selves, Jamie. I mean, it took me a long time. I did not speak English until I was 5. Painfully shy, hyper unskillful, felt misunderstood, felt unseen. I mean, I get how bad it can be. It's a very visceral feeling for me. And so that's why I'm on this mission to help people appreciate that you matter. And the way for people to know that you matter is through your words. So you need to make them matter.
I perceive communication as a two-way street. I see it. It's not only what you mean to say, it's understanding what other people are saying to you and making them understand that you do hear them and that you understand what they are saying. Does that come into play in the work that you do as well?
100%. You nailed it. Communication is a team sport. It is not a solo act. And so that back and forth is what we need. Just like we collaborate at work, right? We need to have it in our communication. So I really hope with the book to help people reframe communication. I think of it as the absolute ultimate currency. It is how we get work done. It is how we go through life. And if you think about that, then you think about, well, am I investing in the one thing that makes the biggest difference for me? And that's what I really want to help people appreciate for their own selves. I'm not here to make anyone do anything, but I hope that people will come away and say, you know what? She's right. If I were not, you know, silent on the sidelines, if I didn't feel beige or what have you, I would be able to contribute more. I feel better about myself. Life would be better.
I interview a lot of people, and some people are good communicators and some people less so. Many people, they think they're good communicators, but others may not agree that they're good communicators. What are some of the most common blind spots or communication traps that you see in the people that you're working with, and how can you bridge the gap?
Yeah, that's a great call out. I think 5 things come to mind. I thought about this. First is when there's silence or like, oh, people agree. Wouldn't necessarily say that. It's about what the silence mean. Mm-hmm. And it's on each of us to confirm understanding. And it can be a simple thing to say, hey, I've said a lot. Let me pause. What are you hearing? And hear what people hear. If they get it, you're like, ah, that's awesome. I'm glad that we have understanding. If not, the answer is, oh, that's great. I realize I wasn't as clear as I needed to be. I want to reinforce X, Y, Z. Because it's really all of our job to make sure that we have understanding. I think a second thing is people think, oh, I'm super approachable. People like me. I mean, that's great that you're approachable, but that does not mean people are speaking power to truth. You know, they may be talking to you, but they're not telling you what you need to hear. And I love the GE chairwoman, vice chair. She may not be there anymore, but she would go to a site visit and she'd be saying, hey, I need you to tell me something that you don't think I want to hear. And she really earnestly wanted to hear it. So she thanked people and she welcomed hearing what people might perceive as bad news. And that normalizes, not only can you say it, but it's like, you need to say it. We need everybody in the company really saying it. And then one, I saw this literally live and it just made me cringe. And it was said with positive intention, but a very senior person said, we have an execution problem. And we're like, wow, you just said to everybody who is killing themselves to execute, by the way, that basically they're lazy or not working hard. Now, I know that's not what the person intended, but executives need to own, hey, we may not be as clear in direction, so maybe people don't know what to do, or it's our job if we don't have the right people in the right job doing the job the right way. And so there's an ownership piece there.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the fourth thing is, you know, nothing is more annoying to your high-performing people than when they have to do the work that the non-performing people are doing. So we have to keep standards. It's really important to have very clear standards that we really want to hold everyone up to support the team. And if someone's not cutting it, we can be open about it and say, we're here to support you any way we can. But if we don't get to this level of performance, it's not going to work. And I would say the last thing is, you know, I understand the participatory management. People want to get people's feedback, but sometimes the leader and your call is you get to make the call. You've decided. If you've decided, please don't pretend that you want people's feedback. Just let them know, hey, with what I knew or with the timing, this is the call I made and this is it. Done. Don't pretend that you're taking people's input when you really have made the decision.
Yeah, that's performative, right? I mean, I've both been on projects where I'm not leading and projects where I am leading. And I find, although I don't usually play well with others, when I'm leading and I'm clear in my intent, I'm a very sort of blunt instrument. It actually gets received a lot better than I think it will be. I think people actually want to know that you've made a decision. They may not agree with it. But I think if you've made it and you're not really prepared to revisit it, you might as well be honest about it. I think that's what you're saying.
Absolutely. And it can be done in a way, Jamie, where people realize it's not that I don't think you're smart and I'm not trying to be mean. So I think that folks need to appreciate things can be said in a way which can land well. And that's on all of us to do. Now, I just want to normalize for folks. You can do everything right, right? But people don't receive it the way you want. That's okay. That's part of it. But you go to bed thinking, I did what I thought was right to the best of my ability, and you sleep well at night.
Do you think it's imperative that people fine-tune what they're saying, understanding that the audience may not be with them, whether it's because maybe they're just not good listeners or not they're not as smart or whatever it is? Do you find yourself telling people, the people that you're consulting with, that they kind of have to change the way they're communicating, or is that not relevant?
I think that it... You know, the best communicators can read an audience and understand where the other people are. So I don't know that I would say that it's changing so much as I want to be effective in support of serving the whole of the greater good. And these people are fundamental to that success. So I need to come across in a way where they get it and they understand it and they're bought in. They may not agree. You said that earlier. People may not agree, but they'll understand if you explain, hey, this is why I made the call. I may be wrong, but this is the way we're going. And I appreciate everyone aligning with that. And we give it our college best.
Okay. So sometimes you have to give bad news, right? Like whether you're leading or you're part of a team or whatever it is, whether it's at work or at home, there's something that needs to be said and it's not going to be received well. How do you communicate those types of messages? Still kind of keeping people psychologically safe, but saying what needs to be said.
Yeah, I love this. So I would just go to the simple, powerful, say it skillfully framework, me, you, we. And the first thing is like, you're like, oh, this is bad news. So what's my relationship with it? Oh, I feel terrible. Okay, why do you feel terrible? Why are people going to feel, are people going to feel bad because you're telling them the truth? Presuming what you're doing is serving and is in service to the greater good. So get clear that what you're saying is you need people to be on the same page. And you respect people. So you want to show them that you respect them by being open and honest. So that hopefully one gets out of my own way first to say, okay, it's not about me. It's about my job is to help everybody get on the same page, this accurate shared reality notion so that we can make the best decisions, execute with speed, and get to our greatest outcomes. So when I'm in a good relationship myself, I can then say, you know, where are they? And you might realize, you know, people are freaking out, they're panicking. Hey, so now I realize I need to have a little bit of kid gloves and show some compassion for people that this might be hard, but that we're going to be better for this and we'll get through it together. So I think that those kinds of quote unquote bad news are great opportunities to strengthen relationships, to build trust, and to help people realize we can overcome adversity and be better for it.
So let's lean into this notion of building trust. What do you think is a critical first step if you're in a situation where you need to build some trust amongst a group that you're communicating with?
Vulnerability is a must for trust, and it is a judgment call. But people, are, especially with a leader, are looking for the leader to showcase, you know, I don't know. I don't have all the answers. I'm not always right. And it's a fine line, right? Because we still want people to believe that we're in the position because we should be, which you do, you are. But being human and showcasing that you're not there to be Mr. or Miss Right, that you appreciate the collective genius that's in the room, that you can't solve this on your own, that you might not know the answer. Gary Ridge, who's a former CEO and chairman of WD-40 Company, is a mentor. And he's like, I don't know, were his three most powerful words. And that just lets people realize, you know what, I can be real. And not only can I be real, I need to be real, because that's the kind of culture that's going to help everybody spread their wings and fly.
I think it's about authenticity. I think people need to believe that if you're communicating with them, you're being yourself. You're not just putting on an act. I think people can read and see through that pretty quickly.
Huge point. So authenticity, Marshall and I do define this a bit in the book, because people, I think, can use this as an excuse. Well, authentically, you know, I'm this or that. And that might be the case. When we're in groups, we're here to serve the whole. So authentic to us is being who you need to be to best serve the group, to best serve the greater good. And being so genuinely is to your point. You can't be lying, faking, making it up, because people know.
They do.
And so that's not easy. Because sometimes, you know, let's say you're in a meeting and you're super angry, legitimately so, and you have to go to another meeting in 30 seconds and you need to like really let go of that, because you can't show up angry and ticked off at this next meeting. That takes work. That's real work to be able to say, let me exhale this legitimate but negative energy that's not going to serve the group when I go in there. And how do I let that go and show up as my best self? And that's a real challenge for leaders who know you're always in the spotlight. People are watching you, right? They are keying off on your mood. We're saying they're going to make up stuff. So it's really important that leaders, you know, realize how much people look to them for how things are going.
I think it's also a matter of confidence, right? I think people want to believe that whoever is leading them, whether it's in the family scenario or at work, are confident. So if you're saying something like, I don't know, you also have to say, I don't know, but that's okay, because we can figure this out.
I think exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I think you're showing the confidence is, I know I don't have the answer right now. There is zero doubt in my mind with the incredibly smart people in this room that we will absolutely figure it out.
Fantastic. For those who are interested, Molly is offering her mini audio book, Say It Skillfully, The Me, You, We Framework, and making it available for free at sayitskillfully.zoundy.com/podcast giveaway. We're going to put that in the show notes so that everybody can click onto it. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It was an absolute joy, and I wish you and your viewers all the best.
That was Molly Chang. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to grow a continuous vegetable garden on The Tonic. Feeling low on energy? Orange Naturals can help. For over 15 years, Orange Naturals has been making family-friendly natural health supplements, including their B-complex with L-theanine, right here in Canada. This synergistic blend of full-spectrum active B vitamins boosts energy production by helping you metabolize carbs, fats, and proteins more efficiently. Plus, each dose contains 200 milligrams of L-theanine to promote relaxation without reducing alertness. Find Orange Naturals B-Complex at grocery stores like Loblaws and Metro, pharmacies like Shoppers Drug Mart and Rexall, or online at well.ca and orangenaturals.com.
I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Charlie Nardozzi is a regional Emmy Award-winning, nationally recognized garden writer, speaker, radio, and television personality. He's worked for more than 30 years bringing expert gardening information to home gardeners through radio, television, talks, tours, online, and the printed page. Charlie delights in making gardening information simple, easy, fun, and accessible to everyone. His latest book is The Continuous Vegetable Gardener, and it will be available in February. Welcome to the show, Charlie. How are you?
I'm very good. How are you, Jamie?
I'm doing really well. So I do a bit of gardening. We discussed it briefly before coming on the show. But I want to know what a self-sustaining garden is and why that would be something that somebody would want to have.
Yeah, so it's a good question. When I talk about a continuous vegetable garden, people often wonder, what does that mean? And what I think most people want to do with their edible gardens is they want to have a continuous supply of fresh food, whether it be vegetables, herbs, or fruits, all through the season, and not go through that cycle of gluts. So for those who are gardeners will probably understand that, where you planted too many beans or too much lettuce or whatever it is, and then you don't have any lettuce for the rest of the season. So the book really has that as a premise to be, how can we get a nice continuous supply of food right through the season and do it in an ecologically friendly way and do it where it's going to be less work for you and probably save you some money too. So we have chapters that deal with all of that in the book.
Okay, so when you're talking about the season, you're not talking about the year, you're talking about the growing season, which would change
right
from climate to climate, I would presume.
Exactly.
Right?
So up in Canada, just like in Vermont where I am, it'll probably be talking about maybe 8 months or so. You know, I usually tell people that you probably, following this method, you probably can have things to eat from anywhere from April to November, December. So you obviously, this time of year in January, you're not going to have much going on unless you bring it indoors. I do have a chapter just on growing things indoors as well.
Can anyone be a self-sustaining gardener, or is this better suited for somebody who has a little bit of experience?
I think anybody can do it. You know, I have a specific chapter just on garden design, because I know a lot of times people may have read about companion planting or intercropping or interplanting or succession planting, some of these techniques they might have heard of, but they really don't have a visual of what that looks like. So I created a chapter just on that where it's all done graphically and it's done with raised beds and containers, so it's good for small spaces, and it shows you what your garden should look like in this raised bed in the spring, what it'll look like in the summer, what it'll look like in the fall. So you have very specific information you can follow to actually grow one of these continuous vegetable gardens in your yard. And for those who have experience doing that, of course, I have chapters that go a little bit deeper on things like letting some of your vegetables self-sow or your herbs self-sow. I do that with lettuce all the time, where instead of cutting it off when it starts flowering and goes by and ripping it out, I let it self-sow. So those seeds drop to the ground, they start growing either in the fall or the next spring, depending on where you live, and you get a free crop of lettuce seeds, and you have fun with it because you become a garden editor. Now you go out there and you can dig them up in the spring and move them to where you want them all around the garden. So there's things that are a little more advanced in the book, as well as great tips for beginners.
Yeah, now you mentioned raised gardening off the top, and actually I have three raised gardens, and I think that's actually the key to getting a longer season. Mine is like a zinc-coated corrugated metal, and it tends to warm up earlier, which means the soil's warmer and things seem to grow earlier and later, because I imagine our climates are similar in Vermont and here in Toronto.
Those metal raised beds are great for that, and to get extend the season either way. And I talk about raised beds in the book because most gardeners are small space gardeners now, so they're trying to maximize their yields. The one thing you have to watch out for, of course, with a raised bed garden that's made from metal, and you may have had this experience, is that come summer, that metal can get really hot, and it can really make the soil very hot. So if you're trying to grow an extra crop of peas or an extra lettuce crop in the middle of the summer, you may see that it doesn't do so well. So you have to kind of be strategic about what you're planting when. And I actually, when I talked about that design chapter, there is a design for hot climate vegetables and what plant vegetables you should have in that kind of container that will do well in the real warm parts of the summer.
Yeah, I mean, what I do is I put the plants that seem to do better in the sun, like tomatoes and basil, in the more sun-oriented areas, and then move the lettuces to where there's more shade. They seem to do better in the shade. At least that's my experience.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, there's a number of vegetables, not just lettuces, but a lot of leafy greens, root crops,
kale,
that you can grow in a part shade garden. So if you're looking at your yard and thinking, I don't have enough sun, well, there are things you can grow in that garden.
Let's talk about soil, because it's so important to the success of gardening. What would you like to tell the listeners about that?
Well, I did devote one chapter to the soil. I didn't go into it into a lot of depth because I wrote another book a number of years ago called The No-Dig Gardener. And that's all about soil building and doing it in a way that's ecologically friendly that mimics nature. And that's the whole idea, and where we're not turning, tilling, or disrupting the soil at all. What we found out with soil, of course, through soil scientists, is that there are billions of microbes in the soil that create a whole life, a whole network, an ecological habitat that are helping water and nutrients flow between plants, and information, too, between plants. So the more you till it or turn that soil, you disrupt that network, and it has to rebuild itself time and time again. If you don't do that and do a no-dig system, what you're doing is you're adding materials on top of your existing soil, creating a rich soil that's going to have a lot of food for those microbes in there, and your plants are going to grow better. So you can plant things closer together, you're not going to have as much insect and disease issues, and the most important thing for me is it's a lot, lot less work. There's not as much tilling or turning you have to do, you're really just bringing in organic materials and compost to add to the bed each year so that it'll continue being very productive.
Right. I put worms in, and I use the organic worm poop to sort of enrich the soil in between the seasons. And I find with the raised gardens, there's less weeds just because it's literally contained. Okay, so let's talk about the types of vegetables that you choose to put in a sustainable garden like this. I presume it kind of depends on where you're at, right? Because certain vegetables are going to do better in certain climates, right?
Yes, certainly trying to grow up in Toronto, trying to grow some exotic plants, okras or watermelons, depending on the summer, they may or may not do very well. You might end up having beautiful plants with very little fruit at the end of the year. So it does pertain a little bit to where you're growing. But with some of these techniques that we're talking about, raised beds, season extenders, I talk about ways to protect your plants in the spring and fall with different row covers and different things that'll allow you to grow a little bit further either way in the season. You can pretty much grow kind of anything in this kind of system. It's just all a matter of growing the right plant at the right time. So what I put in the book are chapters on different kinds of plants. For example, there's a chapter on perennial vegetables. A lot of people don't think of vegetables as being perennial, but there's a number of great ones you can grow. Certainly asparagus is very familiar, but rhubarb is becoming more and more popular again. Mm-hmm. Horseradish, greens, there's sorrel that will come back year after year. There's even versions of kale and broccoli that you can grow that are perennial plants. This is going to save you time, money, and effort just by having a perennial section of your garden. I mentioned already the self-sowing vegetables like lettuces, any of the greens, mustards, lettuces, arugula, self-sow readily, nasturtiums and cilantro and calendula are some of the flowers and herbs that self-sow. You can save seeds, you can save plants, you can save your sweet potatoes, you can even save your regular potatoes if you do it properly and avoid disease and replant those next year so you don't have to have to purchase all of that stuff every spring. I even have a little section in there if you want to save a favorite pepper plant or tomato plant, how to do it, bring it indoors, overwinter it, and then put it back out next year because it is a perennial plant, and you'll have a jump start on the season. So there's lots of different ways that I try to get people into that habit of growing more food and doing it in a continuous way and saving time and money.
I found with tomatoes specifically, the smaller tomatoes, the cherry tomatoes or the grape tomatoes, do better in my raised garden, and they're a lot less maintenance than the bigger tomatoes. And that's through like having done this for like a decade. It just, and I'm just a lazy gardener, but I think what you're trying to do is to get people to garden and perhaps not have to put all the work in. But I find with those smaller sized fruits on the tomatoes, it works much better for me.
Yes, there's certainly a good option for tomatoes because you get so much fruit from one plant. You know, I always grow a couple different plants, and I always kick myself in the summer. It's like, I only needed one of these plants.
100%.
So much fruit coming from it.
I have to do notes at the end of the season to make sure I don't make the same mistakes twice.
Exactly, yeah. And cherry tomatoes are something that you can save the seeds from. If you have a special variety that's open pollinated, not a hybrid, you can save the seeds from them year after year and really kind of have that favorite plant growing each season for you.
So when we bought the property that we had, there was actually, and it was very overgrown, black raspberries, which I didn't know what they were. I thought they were blackberries at first. I really didn't know much about gardening at that point, but I did a little bit of research and I figured out how to keep them growing without overtaking my entire backyard. We've talked a lot about vegetables. Let's talk about fruit. What do you recommend with respect to growing fruit?
Yeah, so for fruit, if you choose the right fruits and right varieties, of course, for your area, you can literally have fresh fruit coming out of your garden from May till November or December. And that's what we have in our garden in Vermont. And you start with the early season things. There's one fruit that many people are not familiar with called honeyberries. And this is a shrub. It looks kind of like a spirea shrub, 2 to 3 feet tall and wide. It has these beautiful purple berries that fruit 2 weeks before strawberries are ready. So it's really early in the season. It's not something you're going to sit and eat out of hand so much, but where I use it is for shakes or for cooking and things of that nature. It's got a really deep purple color, really healthy fruit to grow. So you start with that, and then you're growing different varieties of strawberries, raspberries you were mentioning, black raspberries, blueberries, dwarf fruit trees, cherries, plums, apples, all of these. What I do in the book is I, again, gear it towards small space gardening. So I'm looking for varieties that are self-pollinating. You don't need two different varieties to get fruit from them. I'm looking for dwarf varieties. There are lots of varieties of bush fruits now that can be grown in containers. There's a group called Bushel and Berry that has a lot of varieties of blueberries and raspberries that you can grow in a container on a deck. So using techniques like that and growing the ripe fruits in your yard, you can create a landscape that has lots of fresh fruit coming from it. And I do it in a way that, again, is ecologically friendly. So I do it with understory plantings of like strawberries underneath fruit trees or berry bushes. The strawberries spread, they're a ground cover, they keep the weeds out, and you get the berries from them as well as the berries from that tree or shrub too.
Time for one last quick question. We've talked about the beginning of the season. Let's focus quickly on the end. What can we do to protect our vegetables from frost and extend the season?
Yeah, so with raised beds, as you know, Jamie, they're easy to protect things because they're raised up. You can put little hoops on them, and you can get these materials called row covers. And they're like a fleece material, and they come in different weights. The heavier the weight, the more it's going to protect the plants deeper into the winter. And that's a nice thing to start using in the fall when you have frost predicted and you want to get through that first or second frost and then maybe have another 3-4 weeks of growing. So I use those a lot in our garden to protect them. For insects, there's a version of that called the micromesh, which is a really a fine window screen-like material. That's not going to protect them from cold, but it protects them from insects. And that's a good way to avoid having to spray a lot of things in your garden. You just use these micromeshes over your plants, and they grow fine under there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You're very welcome.
That was Charlie Nardozzi. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to demolish your comfort zone on The Tonic. The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to organic, local, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since opening in Toronto in 1983. They're a one-stop shop for health and wellness, offering organic produce, natural grocery, natural beauty and skincare products, and a holistic dispensary for natural supplements and more. The Carrot Kitchen and coffee bars serve delicious meals and drinks using high-quality ingredients sourced from local farmers and suppliers that prioritize organic, non-GMO, and/or sustainable practices. Visit one of their two locations in Toronto today. Shop the Big Carrot on Instacart now.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
Art Turek has the distinction of being an elite performer in both business and athletics. For 3 decades, he's delivered speeches and executive coaching for 125 Fortune 500 companies. To spice up his exercise program, Art took up sprinting at the age of 55. Wow, good for you. He continues to enjoy a career in masters track and field. In 2015 and 16, his pentathlon scores at the USA Track and Field Masters Championship earned a silver and a bronze medal, plus number 8 world ranking for his age group. Since 2016, Art has conducted over 1,200 self-experiments to demolish comfort zones and to develop his ability to take extreme accountability for achieving breakthrough results. In 2018-20, he orchestrated the Extraordinary Freedom Experiment to empower high achievers in business, military, consulting, and track athletes to field test his 6 unconventional practices in pursuit of their heartfelt goals. He's also the author of Demolishing Your Comfort Zones, which we're going to be discussing today. Hi, Art. How are you doing?
I'll tell you, here are 2 core points I want to set the stage, Jamie. Comfort kills more dreams than failure ever will. And comfort zone demolition makes wellness sustainable for you and the people around you.
You're new to the show, but regular listeners know that I had a career change. I was a commercial litigator for 20 years. I lost 52 pounds, changed my life. And if I hadn't been prepared to take a risk of sort of changing careers midlife, I wouldn't be where I am today. So I'm with you. What is fundamentally flawed about the way most people set and pursue goals? What do you think?
First, don't set goals. When people set goals, they measure up to social standards of success. And we have categories: health, financial, family, work, social. And the parameter is set realistic goals in those categories. Guess what? We end up with copycat goals. Conceive. This is the skill I teach. Conceive heartfelt yet uncomfortable goals, and you use a precise series of provocative questions like, what's a longstanding lifestyle habit you've wanted to replace with a more effective habit? What's a compelling wellness goal you're close to giving up on and it's haunting you? If a wellness expert tracked your lifestyle habits, what improvements would he or she recommend?
So what I'm hearing from you isn't necessarily that you shouldn't have goals, but maybe you should kind of reconceive the notion of the goals.
Precisely. Now let's look at pursuit of goals too, because here's the real key. You need to declare no matter what commitments. So Jamie, I'm going to read to you in the audience a quote on millions of Starbucks cups. My quote, the way I see it, series number 200. Listen, there's a difference between interest and commitment. When you're interested in doing something, you only do it when circumstances permit. When you're committed to something, you accept no excuses, just results. And I'll add to that, you keep your word to do what's required to achieve results. Huge difference. Declare commitments.
I, from my experience, and I've achieved a lot of things that people would consider to be quite difficult. Like, you know, if you're talking about health and wellness, for example, like losing 52 pounds and keeping it off for over 2 decades, that makes me an outlier. And I've come to the realization, like, setting about a goal to lose weight is one thing, but it's the sustainability that makes the difference. In other words, how are you going to do it day in, day out, which is kind of what I think you're talking about. Am I right about
exactly.
that?
Exactly. What are the required actions? And keep your word about it. And that's the commitment.
So in your book, you outline 6 unconventional practices. Which one do you think tends to create the fastest visible change? And why is that?
It's a mindset disturbance drill where you rephrase instantly your self-limiting beliefs. I call it guy on the couch chatter. So okay. For instance, I'm on an airplane. My seatmate is a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army, Dave Foley. And Dave and I are having a fabulous conversation. And all of a sudden he says, Art, I am not very creative. And I pause. I actually tossed at him a red flag that the National Football League coaches toss at referees
yep.
when they make bad calls.
Yep.
I said, Dave, I'm not creative. Sounds like a genetic defect. You're flawed and finished for life. I think a more empowering way of looking at that, what you really mean, is that in the past when I've had creative endeavors, my results haven't measured up to my expectations. His jaw dropped.
Mm-hmm.
instant impact, and that stayed in his brain. He went back to the base over the next months and years and started doing innovation projects. And I got kept getting invited to raise responsibility ceremonies. Ultimately, he became general. Talk about impact.
How do we raise the difference between or understand the difference between performance and development? Like one seems to be a result and the other seems to be process. That's what I would say. Is that correct? Yeah, or do you see it differently?
You're right on point. Yeah, performance is today's capability. It's about tangible results. Development is about capacity building. What is the skill proficiency that you can aim toward in the future? So you start looking at new performance standards that you can strive for, like being a better podcast interviewer or a manager or a parent. So just say the words properly, and your distinction, Jamie, is right on point.
It seems to me like if you want to be proficient in something, you kind of have to do it. Do you know what I mean? Like if you listen to my interviews back when I started, I was pretty good. But if you do something enough, I think in The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell talks about 10,000 hours of practice in doing something. Does that fit into your paradigm, or is that something different?
I don't play about number of hours. I look more at looking to demolish comfort zones. So okay. Anytime you hit into a comfort zone, what can you do next? For instance, being trapped in a comfort zone, particularly successful people,
yep,
they hit what's called a winning formula. I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. Just keep doing more. More of the same? No. You need to start breaking away. And so you, in my introduction, you showed exactly what I did. I went from exercising to then, which was largely jogging for wellness,
yep,
to sprinting at age 55.
Yep.
It's ridiculous. I defied the odds, the normal standards. And then I decided to become a competitive athlete. I kept going out of my comfort zone, started winning medals at Washington State over and over again. And I said, you got that handled. That's your winning formula. If you want to keep to that, no. And then I got really bold and said, let me go to USA Track and Field Nationals. And I finished 10th.
Let's talk about for a second. I want to understand this notion of a comfort zone and why it's bad. So if somebody is successful and they're repeating the process over and over again and they maintain a level of success, why do you say that's bad? Why is that a comfort zone and why does that need to be changed?
Not necessarily that it's bad. It's like you make a choice. And if you're doing it, if you're staying in it for comfort, fine.
Yep.
But the people I speak to look to achieve and keep exceeding their expectations. There's a fascination of what's possible. And that's who I'm speaking to with my readers and your listeners. People are striving for breakthroughs, just like you did with the incredible weight loss, and you've kept it off. So that's what I'm looking toward. And so when my colleague, Charlie Brucato, said to me, okay, Art, you've got this handled, but you can't seem to be able to win a medal, which is really your goal, you're not going to do it as a sprinter. Face reality. Try pentathlon. You got a strong upper body. You might be good in the throws, like the decathlon, like the discus,
right,
and the javelin. So I said, whoop, gulp. And then, ooh, wow, I better find some great coaches. And sure enough, I did. And within 5 years, you already described the medals that I won. That never would have happened if I had stayed comfortable. I had to go gulp and bam. And believe me, here's the other thing. I was born missing an inferior vena cava.
Hmm. Why do you think, is it people are afraid to be in a state of you know, failure or discomfort? Is that what's holding people back?
Yeah, I think that's a big piece of it. It's discomfort or failure. And actually, there is no failure. Let's bring that point to the board.
Right.
I mean, the point is there's no failure as long as you're willing to learn. So any kind of result, unwanted outcome, fine. Opportunity to learn from it and benefit from that. Put that learning into action.
I understand you have an offer for the listeners today. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. One of the things I'd love to invite for your listeners is comfort zone demolition coaching. And so that is an invitation, free 1 hour complimentary. We see if we're a good fit. And if we both decide, hey, this is the kind of relationship that can lead to breakthroughs, let's go do it. Let's go do it. But that is absolutely a complimentary. Simply come to my website. There'll be a Work with Art page, and they can enter the information and sign up.
Very quickly, what's that website?
Yes, it's artcharak.com.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Colleen Hartwick, Molly Chang, Charlie Nardozzi, and Art Turek. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.